Good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to the Lou Jones Supreme Court, Bankruptcy and the Supreme Court presentation. Returning with us once again this year to present on the Supreme Court's pending bankruptcy cases and cases that might be in the pipeline are Frank DeCastri to my immediate right from the Reinhardt firm. And the old timer, the person who's been doing this, I think, since the beginning, right?
Yeah. Well, not
we're going to call it since the beginning. Tom Schreiner from the
since 1898.
No. From the beginning of this event, when I think our former colleague Judge Kelly started this undertaking, it was you and Pete Blaine, right?
Right.
So, yeah. All right. Enough about that. On with the show.
Frankly, heard of the Reinhardt spot.
I did. Okay. You want to do a little intro?
Well, sure. As the chief judge just reminded us, we've been doing this for a while, not because we're any good at it, but because the Bar Association wants something it can have a CLE about. And there are people who actually practice in this area.
No, this is just us.
Huh?
This is just us.
Oh, it's not the
District Bar. Lou Jones. This is the
court.
Yeah, this
is that why we don't
Kelly's
have,
creation to,
that why we don't
to educate
any...
people on the 2005 Act, and here we are 19 years later. Yeah. We're still educating people.
On the 2005 Act and
no,
the 1978
Act. No, that and other things, right.
So, yeah, that explains why we don't have any
We've got to get our credit. It's part of our duty to, you know, to engage the bar and promote the fair administration of justice.
Anyway, we have fun doing it. I hope you do, too. We do not mind being interrupted. We actually like it. Just shout out, and we'll take up your questions or comments or whatever you have to say. Don't know how you do that from your remote location, particularly that guy who was driving his car while he was listening. But the idea was we would talk about what the Supreme Court did during the last term. And most terms it does something. This year it did a lot. Three cases came down this last term. We talk about that. When we don't have anything interesting there, we look at what's in the pipeline. There is one case that the Supreme Court has granted cert on that is going to be argued at some point in next calendar year, but before June. So, well, theoretically, we'll have something to talk about next year. That's an interesting case in which the Tenth Circuit disagreed with the Seventh Circuit, among others. We'll get to that at the end if we have time. And then, you know, when we don't have anything else to talk about Seventh Circuit opinions, because there's usually something coming down from the Seventh Circuit, whether it's going any farther than that or not. So that's how we do it. And as I say, we have fun with it, and we try not to be too scholarly or academic, right?
It's easy for
pedantic.
Me.
Pedantic.
Right, exactly. Now, this year, you know we're going to talk about Purdue Pharma, because that's all anybody cares about. Frank, being an expert on it, we've talked about it a couple times before as it got on its way up. You're really going to not allow releases of claims by non-debtors against by non-creditors against non-debtors? Yeah, I don't know, whatever. Yeah, they did. So, 5-4.
Yeah.
We know what the law is now.
Wow. We do. Yeah. I'll go through this. This will take a while to get through. You may have noticed if you looked at the outline before coming here today that there's
over half.
The piece on Purdue Pharma is pretty lengthy. Before I start, though, I will sort of say what we're not really talking about as a means of narrowing in on what we are talking about with Purdue Pharma. We're not talking about releases by a debtor or by the estate, which are distinct things. And we're not talking about exculpation clauses, which you often see in plans that provide certain protection for professionals and other
lawyers,
fiduciaries in the case.
Yeah,
exactly. Maybe directors and officers.
Yeah.
But we are talking about releases that affect by non-debtors against non-debtors, and in this particular case, without the consent of everyone involved, That's how the case got here. We did have some objectors, including those pesky Canadian predators.
Yeah, the Canadians.
It's always the Canadians. This case really focused around Section 1123B, which has a list of the things that it's a non-exhaustive list, I think. There is a catch-all, which we'll talk about at the end. The things that a plan may include, and it generally talks about treatment of claims and executory contracts, settlement of disputes, sale of assets, modifying rights of parties that are involved in that kind of thing. And then at the end of this, it says, and the plan may also include any other appropriate provision not inconsistent with the applicable provisions of this title.
So we talk about appropriate and not inconsistent with applicable provisions of the title. But it turns out at the end of the day, is it like the first five? It's probably the rule, right?
Right. Okay. So the background to this, if you're not at least somewhat familiar with it, is Purdue Pharma was the maker of OxyContin. As the opioid epidemic worsened in the country, people started to turn their attention to lawsuits against the company, its affiliates, and in some cases even the Sackler family, which is the family that had the majority of control over Purdue Pharma. Things really started to get interesting in 2007 when there was a criminal case. I couldn't tell you which state it arose out of, against an affiliate of Purdue Pharma. And in that case, the company, and I don't know if the, at a minimum, the company was found guilty of sort of misrepresenting what OxyContin did and its safety and the like. They had advertised OxyContin as something that was actually less addictive than other pain-killing medication, sort of less problematic in general. And out of that came a criminal conviction. After that point, and the majority opinion sort of goes through this at some length.
Sure, leads off with it.
Leads
it?
Off with it. Yeah, they clearly didn't like the majority what happened here. Somebody in a deposition or at a trial described this as a milking program, which is to say that the evidence showed that the Sackler family started pulling a lot of money out of the companies after this 2007 conviction.
Scores of times amount taken out of the company than they had ever done before.
Yep, right? Yep. I think they used to pull out, I forget what it was, 15% or something. This was, I've got the numbers written in here somewhere. This was the highest amount that it had ever been. A total of some $11 billion were pulled out, put in offshore trusts and spendthrift trusts and all sorts of things that were designed to protect the money. Eventually, and it was not much later, I think it was in 2019, they put Purdue Pharma into bankruptcy. The lawsuits by that point had, there were over 400 actions that were pending against the company, and the demands exceeded $40 trillion. Purdue proposed a plan. The idea was that Purdue Pharma would become sort of this public benefit company that would be dedicated to opioid abatement.
Only a bankruptcy lawyer could come up with a line. Yeah.
Public benefit. It created a trust of money that these victims could go after. In the end, it appeared, subject to certain, deductions that would apply, that victims would recover anywhere from $3,500 each to $48,000. And the Sacklers did agree to contribute about $4.3 billion at the outset to this trust. So you know, you can tell the majority opinion they're going through this and saying, well, okay, you took $11 billion out. How nice of you. You put $4.3 billion back in.
You're going to keep the rest of it?
Yeah. Oh, and in exchange for that, they got what you would expect they would want, which is a complete release of all claims. And it extended to all sorts of family members.
They weren't in bankruptcy themselves?
All sorts of types of claims, including fraud. Pretty much everything, the Sacklers were walking away from this without having to worry about it anymore. The plan did not require affirmative consent through any kind of an opt-out, which we tend to see sometimes in these cases. And it did get, for those who participated in the voting, it did get a lot of support. I think it was 95% support. The majority points out that it was only
20%
or so who actually participated in the voting. And so left standing at the end were a group of Canadian creditors who were objecting, some individual creditors, the U.S. Trustee's Office, eight states and the District of Columbia. Nevertheless, bankruptcy court confirmed the plan. District court reversed, vacated the confirmation order, essentially saying we don't see this authority anywhere in 1123. Even the catch-all phrase, it just using that together with Section 105 goes way beyond what we read in that statute.
Or anywhere in Chapter 11 for that matter, in Title 11 for that matter.
Anywhere in the code. So the the appeals go to the Court of Appeals, and while that appeal was pending, the eight states and the District of Columbia did reach an additional deal with the Sacklers, requiring them to increase their contribution by an additional $1.75 billion. So they're over $6 billion at this point.
They're getting up near a half of what they're
almost a half at this point, yeah. So a divided panel of the Court of Appeals, the Second Circuit, did reverse the district court. They found that this was permissible under Section 1123. It very broadly states that, you know, if it's appropriate, it's allowed. And there was a dissenting opinion by, I don't remember, do you remember the judge's name? Judge Wesley. Mm-hmm. Yeah. He actually concurred in the judgment, but he expressed a lot of skepticism.
He said, I concur only because there is Second Circuit precedent that upholds this procedure. I'm bound by circuit precedent, but I don't like it.
Yep. And he said that the majority errs by inferring a power that is nothing short of extraordinary from what is effectively silence in Section 1123 B6. The Court of Appeals did adopt this balancing test, which really was present in a lot of these third-party release cases in the past, you know, 10, 20 years. And I'm not going to go through all of them. The dissent actually went through a lot of them in its lengthy opinion. But they went back and essentially kind of did the same analysis that other courts had been doing on third-party releases. Court of Appeals declined to issue a stay, but then the Supreme Court did, which put Purdue's plan on hold in August of 2023.
That's what you call a bad sign.
Yep.
When the court of which you're going grants a stay of your victory as you go.
Easy to read the tea leaves on that one.
Well, I can misread them all the time, but it didn't look good.
The petitioners argue that code has no express authority to release non-debtors, and there's no basis to infer sort of a vast power from the residual provisions in 1123 and Section 105.
Section 105, of course, is that old chestnut that says do the right thing, right? You got a lot of power to do things.
To carry out
what
it is you're trying to do.
But it's no more explicit in allowing it than 1123 is. It's just, got a lot of power, your court of equity, but it has failed as a justification for lots of things that bankruptcy judges have wanted to do from time to time. And bankruptcy practitioners have wanted judges to do because it doesn't really say that much.
Want me to say 105 says?
Sure. Yeah.
105A, relevant provision says, court may issue any order, process, judgment that is necessary, appropriate to carry out the provisions of this title.
That is the bankruptcy code.
Right.
Yeah. Anyway.
So one of the other issues that you see pop up,
Judge Easterbrook was never fond of 105. I remember one of, as a source of authority for creative bankruptcy lawyers and judges.
Yeah, and
is
I think
that fair, Judge Hoffinger. You
well, the Supreme Court hasn't been overly enamored with it either.
Right, that's right.
Yeah, I think the law seems to be pretty well settled now, and certainly after Purdue Pharma, seems to be even more settled that 105 can only be used in conjunction with another provision of the code, so sort of force or implement another provision.
It has often been brought up. I mean, I'm been doing this for a long time. 105 is often brought up as, well, this is really nifty what we want to do. There isn't any authority to do it, but the court is a broad power of equity to do the right thing. So let's use 105. And, sometimes people get away with that.
Did those arguments work more when the code first came out?
I don't think so. I mean, but, it had to do with how do you get around the automatic stay or how do you, lots of things that just – you pull it out because it seems like it gives some authority to do the right thing. And we hear this all the time in the Supreme Court, not just in a bankruptcy context, but, Congress passes a law. They pass some lousy laws. They make some mistakes. They leave things out that people afterwards think should be taken care of and weren't. But that's not obviously an opportunity for the court to come in and say, well, wouldn't this be nifty if we could do this? That would solve a lot of problems. So
another issue that comes up in a lot of these cases, that an argument that has been raised, is that third-party releases essentially grant the equivalent of a discharge to a non-debtor. And the argument against third-party releases comes from Section 524E, which says, except as provided in another section, which I don't think is pertinent here, discharge of a debt of a debtor does not affect the liability of any other entity on or the property of any other entity for such debt.
But this isn't a discharge. This is a provision in a plan that's binding or not binding on other persons.
But you see, those are word games.
Yeah. Those aren't word games. Those are consistent with the structure of the code.
Yeah. Right.
Sounds like you may be in the dissent.
On that point,
there is a clear distinction between a discharge and a third-party release.
Yeah. But at the end of the day, it just means you don't have to pay your debts, right?
At the end of the day,
I understand it may be practically the same, but the discharge is a specific provision of the code.
Hey, you get a little rubber stamp on your head. You say, George gave me a discharge.
The court issuing an injunction, which is really what this is, although people persist and it's never going to change, of calling them releases. It's really just an injunction.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah.
Again,
like
you get back.
Right?
Yeah. It
just
is
an injunction.
No, well, it carries an injunction with it, but it's a formal declaration that this person has been through this process and is now sacred in a way that he or she didn't used to be, or it didn't used to be.
So to me, that's the question. The question is, can a plan impose what is really injunctive relief in this way?
Yeah.
That to me is the question. And the majority said no, because the catch-all of six is limited to claims against the debtor. And the dissent said there's no reason
Ipsy Dixit.
That's too fair a narrow reading of the catch-all provision six.
Another argument that comes up, and the petitioners certainly raise it here, is that there is also turns to 524. 524G has a specific third-party release provision for mass torts in
asbestos
cases. And the argument of the petitioners here is, well, look, they so narrowly provided for it here, there's no reason to think that 1123B6 provides it
right.
everywhere.
Except for the fact that Congress went out of its way to say, just because we're doing this doesn't mean that you should read a narrower version of the code, right?
Right. That's because the lobbying group that had the clout in Congress to get that passed put that in there, thinking about the later litigation, saying, well, let's get ourselves this too while we're at it.
That is to say, the sausage was made in the usual way.
Right.
They raise some constitutional issues
sure.
as well.
Why not?
Right, throw it in there. And they talk about, which is actually a point that I think, if I'm not mistaken, both the majority and the dissent pick up on, you know, some public interest arguments here. Petitioners are arguing that, you know, this is going to enable tortfeasors to obtain legal immunity. You know, from the claims of their victims without
paying up.
Yep. So the respondents quite naturally say 1123B6 is, you know, it's wide open. It says you can do anything as long as it's the third party releases are appropriate and not inconsistent with the other provisions of the code. They talk about how the law, case law has developed. You know, these are only used in limited and narrow circumstances.
It's interesting because so many of the people advocating for that result were people who normally have no sympathy at all for tortfeasors, right?
Yeah.
But since they're going to get some money out of it, let's get this plan confirmed and get some money paid.
And the bankruptcy court had substantial evidentiary hearings. And made a finding of fact, right, that this provision was necessary to the confirmation of the plan.
Sure. That doesn't surprise me. I think that's probably correct.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, it'll be tested now that we know what the law is. Will the world fall apart because this wasn't the interpretation given to 1123, whatever it is. I suspect not. I suspect they'll find a way to do it. If nothing else, they can go back to Congress and get another law passed.
Well, that yes, because that's it's so easy to get things through Congress. But yeah, that's the.
Well, it'll lead to some more campaign contributions. It's a good thing.
And that is the way that Justice Kavanaugh finished his dissent by yeah. suggesting that chaos would ensue.
Oh, sure.
But also inviting Congress to at least seriously study the issue. Interestingly, the respondents label the U.S. trustee an interloper in the case. Just had to throw that in there, David. And they
loped right in and won, didn't
they? And they complain that this is going to sort of open the floodgates to litigation, invite a race to the courthouse if these kinds of provisions are not allowed. There were more than 20 Amici briefs, which I won't bother to go through all the arguments that were made there. But
some pretty clever.
Some pretty clever. Boy Scouts of America did them. Actually, a couple that were related to the Boy Scouts bankruptcy, a case where they recently confirmed a plan that had substantial third-party releases in it of, at a minimum, the local councils of the Boy Scouts, the different regions all over the country. Among others, I think.
Sponsoring institutions too, I think.
Sponsoring institutions probably.
Yeah.
So, Justice Gorsuch had the majority opinion. It was a mere 19 pages compared to the 54-page dissent. This opinion was joined by Justices Thomas, Alito, Barrett, and Jackson. As we mentioned, the court jumped right into the milking program. They clearly didn't like the facts of this case. Here are the numbers I was talking about before. Prior to that 2007, I guess it was a plea agreement, not a conviction. Less than 15% of Purdue's annual revenue was being pulled out of the company. And after 2007, it was about 70% each year. It drained, they estimate that it drained, these withdrawals by the Sackler family drained Purdue's assets by some 75%.
Just smart bankruptcy planning, right?
Yeah. Yeah, that's right.
You get away with it.
Quite naturally, they turn their attention pretty quickly to Section 1123B. They do note in a footnote, as I mentioned earlier, that Section 105A by itself is not enough. It serves only to carry out authorities that are expressly conferred elsewhere in the code. And they turn their attention to this catch-all paragraph 6 or subparagraph. And they say, look, it's a catch-all. It's tacked on the end of a long and detailed list of specifications. And they say that just because it's a catch-all, it doesn't mean we give it the broadest possible construction that you might think it would have. It has to be interpreted in light of its surrounding context.
Wisdom generous, huh?
And read to embrace things that are similar in nature. And you actually cited this concept in the order relating to the Milwaukee Archdiocese case recently. There you go.
It's a well-traveled principle of statutory construction.
Then they analyze the first five subparagraphs, and they sort of conclude all of this concerns the debtor, the rights and responsibilities and its relationships with creditors. And what's being proposed for B6 is sort of radically different.
So there's the old Sesame Street line about one of these things is not like the other, right? I mean, that's really what it is, a pretty basic concept.
The question is, why doesn't it concern the debtor if this is necessary to get the plan confirmed?
Right. And I suppose it depends on how you define that.
Well, at the end of the day, is confirmation of the plan a public good?
I don't know.
Sometimes it is, sometimes it isn't.
It says appropriate and any appropriate provision not inconsistent with applicable provisions of this title.
I'm bringing a different question. I mean, you could put a lot of crap in a plan and say, well, we wouldn't have gotten it confirmed if we didn't have this in there.
I think they're all private goods. The systems might be a public good. Anyways, let's move on.
Yes.
Because I do have a question that actually troubles me more about the reasoning.
Okay. I hope Tom can answer it. So then they talk a lot about the purpose of bankruptcy law. Actually, they're referring to the dissent when they say that, because the dissent, as we'll point out in a minute, spends a little bit of time talking about what the purpose of bankruptcy law is here. And the majority says that's not going to cut it. No statute pursues a single policy at all costs. And again, this is not the first time in recent years that the Supreme Court has kind of said some of these things. Bankruptcy court's not a roving commission to resolve all problems.
It's powers. What's so good about it, confirming a plan? It's a good at some level for some people, but maybe it's not the right one.
We can have multi-district litigation in front of Article 3, John.
Well, that's all right. Let's work for you, John.
I think that's what they have in mind.
So, and then interestingly, they kind of go through the related provisions in the code that to them, to the majority, demonstrate that 1123B can't be interpreted this way. The discharge provision, which we talked about, Section 524E. There's this interesting concept, and I guess I'm comfortable with it, although it's a little bit funny. A debtor has to come forward with virtually all of its assets and sort of put them all on the table for its creditors. And I guess I've never thought of Chapter 11 as being exactly that. They cite for that Section 541, which is a property estate stuff, and that makes sense. And they cite 548. I guess that's bringing back things that were transferred away from the estate. But that's certainly a theme that runs through the majority's opinion. Debtor's got to bring virtually all its assets, and they use that to point at the Sackler family and say, right. $11 billion versus $6 billion.
It's clearly what rubbed a lot of people the wrong way about this plan. I mean, there's maybe it's surprising that it's 5-4 not to permit it. Maybe it would have been more. And I think a lot of people just said, you know, you shouldn't be able to walk with any money based on what you did. You know, if you want to discharge, if you want to be released, or you want whatever you want, go through the process and do it. Don't get clever having stolen all this money from the people who deserve to have it, the creditors, the tort victims.
You mean taking distributions?
Yeah, taking distributions. Yeah. Anyway, I think that's the underlying sense of it. I wasn't a bit surprised by this result.
And the only thing I was surprised by is like who was in the dissent.
Absolutely.
And some of the things that were said in there by those justices. They also addressed 524G, sort of adopting the petitioner's argument.
That's the asbestos.
Yeah. Well, at least. The fact that it says asbestos here and it's okay there doesn't mean we can say this right. Catch-all phrase means it's okay everywhere. Saying that releases are different from discharges is word games, which clearly upsets my chief judge. And they talk about history. Here, history supports the result. They say going back to the 1800s in terms of debtors being able to offer a fair and full surrender of all their property. There's really no statute or case that suggests that the courts are able to discharge claims brought by non-debtors and so on. And then at the end, the court, the majority sort of decides that or announces what they really aren't deciding. A, whether consensual third party releases are acceptable. B, what qualifies as a consensual release. And C, although I've labeled it D in here. Whether the courts
want us to know what C was.
Whether the courts reading the code would justify unwinding reorganization plans that have already become effective. And that obviously can impact a lot of really big and important cases. The Boy Scouts would be an obvious one because it was sort of one of the more recent and publicized ones, but certainly probably more than one archdiocese case around the country as well.
Seems like you'd have to be within a year, wouldn't it?
Sure would.
Yeah.
Unless you want to throw Rule 60 out too.
So here's my question.
Okay.
Let's say all these objecting people, parties had consented. Could the plan have been confirmed following this decision? Well, and let me read you from the decision, because this is what I find interesting. So this is where they're talking about what appropriate means, right? Instead, Congress sent out a detailed list of powers followed by a catch-all that it qualified with the term appropriate. Quintessentially context-dependent term often draws this meaning from the surrounding provisions, blah, blah, blah. Each of these other paragraphs authorizes a bankruptcy court to adjust claims without consent only to the extent such claims concern the debtor. From this, it follows naturally that an appropriate provision adopted pursuant to this catch-all that purports to extinguish claims, and here's the rub, without consent, should be similarly constrained. Why without consent? If provision 6, the so-called catch-all, is informed by 1 through 5 and is interpreted to mean, because 1 through 5 only apply to things, claims against the debtor, then 6 follows, the reasoning is 6 then only includes things against the debtor, right? Then what the heck difference does it make if there's consent or not?
What good does consent do to get around that?
Right.
Yeah. Right.
And it reads like a sentence that originally said purports to extinguish claims should be like, so from this it follows naturally that the appropriate provision adopted pursuant to this catch-all that purports to extinguish claims should be similarly constrained. And somebody read that. I mean, this is pure speculation on my part, right? But it just reads like I can see someone saying, what about consent? And then we got the sentence the way that it is. But the logic of it, I don't understand.
Yeah. And you wonder what consent means. Does it mean 100% of the creditors voting in favor?
Well, presumably if consent
Every creditor.
I mean, there's a problem with how do you get consent, right? That's one problem. Yep. Setting that problem aside. I think if you had parties that however you define consent, consented, then according to that language, seems like the plan could enjoin those parties from going against the third parties, the non-debtors, right? But it's curious to me, but why that's consistent with the language of the code if the language of the code only applies to claims against the debtor. Because that's what they said. That's the whole reasoning. That's like the linchpin of the decision.
And in a future case, don't you see them saying, well, if they consented, it doesn't really matter. It's consent. It's everybody agreed, and we're not going to argue.
Who's going to comply?
Right, but the plan under 1129 has to in order to be confirmed, has to comply with the provisions of the code. Right. How does that provision comply with the provisions of the code if this decision says that the plan can't alter claims against non-debtors?
But who would complain? The U.S. trustee, I
assume. Right. Yeah, the interlopers.
The interlopers. That's what we got to worry about.
And maybe the answer is you do consent some other way. You enter a separate injunction or something, right? Like there may be other workarounds, but.
Yeah.
Well, this is a great case for the principle that bad facts make bad law. I mean, these are bad facts. This milking program just offended the court, offended a lot of people to high heaven. You go through this sort of, in addition to, selling poison to your customers over the years and killing people and starting a national health crisis, you then grab a bunch of the money you made by this nefarious activity and you say, well, we'll give you some of it back, but we want to keep most of it. Now, let us get away with that.
Yeah, it's the poster child for bad facts, no doubt about that.
Yeah, yeah, it is. Interestingly, so I mentioned the dissent, and then we can come back to wrap it up. But I mentioned 54 pages. This is Kavanaugh, Roberts, Sotomayor, and Kagan.
The liberals.
and Kavanaugh comes right out and says that the plan was a shining example of the bankruptcy system at work, which I found interesting. He really emphasizes how long these have been a critical tool for the bankruptcy courts to handle mass tort bankruptcies. He said this is going to have a debilitating effect on the bankruptcy system at large. Talks about the goal of bankruptcy. They ultimately conclude, look, 1123b6, it's broad enough. Any other appropriate provision, this is fine. It's kind of a if it ain't broke, don't fix it, type mentality, the way I read it.
The opinion of an institutionalist who says this system is working, don't mess with it.
Right, 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 exactly. And he concludes by saying, only Congress can fix the chaos that will now ensue. The court's decision will lead to too much harm for far too many people for Congress to sit by idly without at least carefully studying the issue. So I
sort of raises a question to me, which is, you got people here who are experts in this. You sit on the bench or guard our, U.S. trustees who guard us from depredation and so on. Could the bankruptcy system exist without really playing a role in resolving mass tort cases? My view is, hell yes. There's a lot of important stuff for it to do. And it's not necessarily the best thing that's happened to the bankruptcy system to have to deal with this stuff. It doesn't fit. And maybe the only way you ought to be able to pull the kind of stuff that happens here is if there's a consensus sufficiently broad enough that Congress says, go ahead and do it. They can do whatever they want. But other than that, so what? We'll have a pretty good bankruptcy court anyway, just making guarantors pay, which they never do. Or, whatever it is they normally do. Right? No?
Ultimately,
I'm appealing to you to disagree with me.
I mean, ultimately, one can't, contest the fact that
right.
Congress can fix this. Congress is the one with the power to pass uniform national bankruptcy laws. But aside putting all that aside, The question, I guess, really becomes is, not whether or not the bankruptcy system sets down, but whether or not there I mean, this wasn't really effectively a reorganization either. So, I mean, whether or not it really...
If you're going to end up with a public service...
Yeah, I mean, whether or not you just end up with a bunch of liquidations, right? Like, yeah. Which, although this was sort of a liquidation.
Sort of.
I mean, what you had, what liquidated, you, the problem always is, right, this is the same problem as the sort of Texas two-step cases, is do you, and this ultimately, your answer to this is going to be, well, that's for Congress to decide, is do you really want to channel all this into the MDL system? Right? I mean, this is like an alternative, you know, parties and their lawyers have use the bankruptcy system as an alternative to the very what could be characterized as a very cumbersome MDL process in which you have an MDL court, but to the extent things don't wrap up there, it has to be all sent back to the districts in which the cases arose to be tried.
Maybe.
Right. And like, there's a arguable sort of negotiation efficiency to like working it out.
Maybe. I mean, you know, tort lawyers are pretty good at settling disputes. They don't need a bankruptcy code most of the time.
Right, and, there's a better chance of solving the holdout problems, right, that you have.
I suppose.
Anyways, we can move on, unless you have a wrap-up.
I guess I was just going to say it's clearly a situation where the majority, the facts really mattered here. The majority clearly didn't like what had happened. Right. They didn't like the plan.
And one way to speculate about the fifth member of the majority, right? Whether or not the facts influenced Justice Jackson.
Yeah. Why was she the fifth?
Because
each one of them was the fifth.
If one engages in modern, you know, modern dicing of the court, you know, all the liberals aren't on one side.
I don't know. You know, I was joking earlier about the liberals over the dissenters. But if you want to think about who the institutionalists are on that court, in my view, they are Roberts and often Kavanaugh and the three so-called liberals. They're institutionalists. They kind of believe in doing it, making this system work, and the other four often are bomb throwers, because they think, you know, it's kind of messed up that Congress isn't doing its job and courts are doing too much. And I don't know. It's interesting. I don't know. I can't figure it out.
So the majority don't like the deal even that was struck.
Right. Wasn't a very good deal.
They clearly think that there should be more money on the table. SACRA should be required to put more up there. And, interestingly, the dissent labels that, kind of thinking paternalistic.
Really?
Yeah. So.
And contrary to the findings of fact of the bankruptcy court that weren't contested on appeal.
Because they were irrelevant to the outcome.
Apparently. They certainly became irrelevant.
Well, it happens sometimes. The second case we'll talk about is kind of interesting. We've talked about it in this gathering twice before that I can recall. Once, I think, when it was on its way up to the Supreme Court, and then second time when the Supreme Court decided the constitutional issue that was raised. And now we're on remedy, and it's all very interesting. This is U.S. Trustee versus John Q. Hammonds, not John Q. Hammonds, Fall 2006. I don't know how that got in there. It is a case that really grows out of talk about politics in Congress. The bankruptcy code passage in the Act of 1977, creating the bankruptcy code of 78, apparently one of the things that had to be done to get it through Congress was that two powerful senators, I've forgotten who they are now, Sam Irwin was one of them from North Carolina, and who was one from Alabama?
Strom Thurmond.
Huh?
Strom Thurmond?
No, he's South Carolina.
Heflin?
Heflin. Hal Heflin. Very powerful Democrat, former segregationist who'd gotten religion, more or less, looking after their local people, just screwed up the system. When the U.S. trustee system was created, it didn't exist before, with the view that, you know, the public in the person of an officer in the Department of Justice ought to have some role to play in bankruptcy, which we're still seeing as in the last case, how does that play out? That therefore that role should be played, but the people who are causing the money to be spent should pay for it. And so a U.S. trustee system was created for 46 states and the District of Columbia, as I recall. And when you file a Chapter 11, particularly, because these are usually about 11s, you pay a fee which goes to the U.S. trustee. And it wasn't a bad fee. The other two states, North Carolina and Alabama, had something called bankruptcy administrators. One assumes they were friends of the senators who created the jobs, and I'm sure they were. And they would run on a different system. They would be a part of the court system itself and sort of affiliated with the clerks. And, you know, the fees that were charged initially were pretty much the same. But sometime in, 2017, 2018, Congress, you know, felt the need to get some more money, as it often does, and it jacked up the fees in U.S. trustee cases in Chapter 11s significantly. It was a very significant amount of money, particularly on the bigger Chapter 11s, but didn't do anything about applying that to the bankruptcy administrators in those two states. And some bright fellow in Kansas who had a resort company in Chapter 11 said, well, that isn't right because the constitutional underpinning of the bankruptcy courts is a uniformity clause in the Constitution. We shall have uniform bankruptcy laws. This doesn't sound very uniform to me. It didn't sound very much uniform to me once I realized what had happened. You know, when it was a theoretical matter, you just had a different name to the office. That's one thing. But when it cost you a hell of a lot more money to litigate these issues in some states than it does in other states, it didn't seem right. It didn't seem right to the Tenth Circuit. When this came up to the Tenth Circuit, they said, no, that violates the uniformity clause. So when we first talked about this, it was on its way to the Supreme Court. I think we kind of thought that the Tenth Circuit had gotten it right. We didn't think beyond that, what's that mean? And indeed, in the case that came down called Siegel versus Fitzgerald, the Supreme Court agreed, this isn't right. You can't do this. It's not uniform. You got to make it uniform. Okay, that's fine. This bright guy in Kansas then said, I want my money back. Congress came in and said, going forward, here's the solution. The fees will be the same in all the districts going forward. But didn't say anything about paying refunds to those who had overpaid. It's kind of hard to make the underpayers pay it. Catch up because they aren't around anymore. They've been bankrupt. They're not collectible. So it was either get the U.S. trustee's office, that's just to say the U.S. government, to pay back. How much money was it? A significant amount of money. I've forgotten.
$350 million.
Chump change in Congress when you're talking about $11 billion going to the sackers. But Congress didn't see any need to do that. So the next case that came up was give us our money back, and the 10th Circuit again sided with the Chapter 11 debtor. So government estimated at the time this refund was sought that 85% of the large Chapter 11 cases subject to higher fees between dates in 2018 and 2021 before the Congress raised the amount to be paid and after it had fixed it, had closed. And some of those debtors had been liquidated or otherwise ceased to exist. And for debtors to be paid lower fees, only 10 of the roughly 50 cases were still open. So the government says on this, the court rarely grants requests for retroactive relief. Shouldn't do so here. That's pretty straightforward. You know, don't do it to us. You haven't done it before. We're the government. Don't do it to us. And this is especially so when Congress made clear that it only intended to provide a remedy going forward by amending the law to require administrator districts to charge debtors the same fees as those levied in trustee districts with no mention of a refund. Well, the respondent was appalled. Prospective only relief cannot redress the past constitutional monetary injury. There's no viable option for imposing retroactive fees in bankruptcy administrator districts. So due process means give us some money back. The opinion for the court by Justice Jackson, becoming a bankruptcy expert here, I guess, says the appropriate remedy is prospective parity, requiring equal fees for otherwise identical Chapter 11 debtors going forward, comports with congressional intent reflected in the statute, corrects the constitutional wrong, and complies with due process. Process is what process does. Since the trustees program is supposed to be self-funding, the $326 million that the unhappy debtors are seeking here would have to come out of our pockets as taxpayers. And we really aren't, we really don't care, she says, for the court about high fees, only non-uniformity. So since the fee disparity didn't last long and it was small and Congress's intent was unmistakable, it could have raised the fees on all districts going forward. It was raising fees to keep itself funded. Congress didn't retroactively impose higher fees on the bankruptcy administrator district, so there's no due process violation because it would be difficult and expensive to issue refunds. I mean, everybody who doesn't want to pay his bill ought to come up with these explanations. Right? That's a pain in the ass if I had to do that. There's a dissenting opinion here by another one of the institutionalists, Justice Gorsuch, joined by Justice Thomas and Barrett, whom I'm not classifying here on that. And it focused really on something that had happened, which was that back in the original litigation, the U.S. trustee had promised that if the debtor there succeeded on its claim that the fee disparity was unconstitutional, the government would refund the fees to the extent they were overpaid. They didn't look. The U.S. trustee had his fingers crossed behind his back. Even stressed that Congress had authorized payments of refunds in its most recent annual appropriation law. And the dissenters argued traditional remedial principles require refunds. And this is a great story, a great question. Justice Gorsuch can be kind of snarky in the way he poses his questions. In what world does the promise of a prospective-only remedy do anything to redress your past injuries? A promise of fee uniformity going forward may prevent future discrimination between debtors, but it doesn't do anything to remedy fees actually unlawfully exacted in the past. It's not sensible to ask what remedy the government might prefer. Of course, they're the ones paying the bill. Plaintiffs, not the defendants, have the right to choose the relief they seek. Due process, Justice Gorsuch says, prevents a bait and switch by the government, refusing to honor a remedial path that previously held open to the plaintiffs. We should not be in the business, he said, of tolerating such contrived and self-serving changes in position. So, and, you know, we're sending a bad message. We're sending a bad message. Shouldn't do this.
I think it comes out the same way if the VA districts had been the ones congressionally charging the higher amount and everybody else in the country the lower amount.
They still had powerful senators, so I suspect that wouldn't have happened. But, yeah, I don't know.
It's fighting my hypothetical.
No, I know it is
right,
fighting.
It would be a lot easier.
I know. I fight your hypothetical when I can.
To compensate that.
Yeah, I agree. You know, they'd write that out of their petty cash, right? Yeah, that would have been taken care of. It would be a different constitutional principle involved.
Right.
That didn't cost much. Is that a principle?
And
principle of economy and bankruptcy?
And it's easier to view it as the wrong really was undercharging the VA districts, yeah, not overcharging everybody else. Right. And if you view it that way, then you're not very troubled by it, right?
Yes, that's right.
If you view it the other way around, and there's really no structural difference between my hypothetical where it's the two versus the many, right? And so then you just got to wonder, well,
when the majority picks up on that, sort of saying, look, the whole point of this was to increase fees to
right,
make it self-funding, right?
And we just forgot to do these two.
Right.
Mike, you're absolutely right. I agree with you.
Thanks.
Don't say that often.
It's what you used to tell me all the time when we were down the street together.
All right.
All I got to say about that case.
Okay.
Don't expect that to be repeated.
Well, yeah, because you don't want to spend. We've got to move on to truck insurance.
Right. Truck Insurance Exchange versus Kaiser Gypsum Company.
Is this asbestos?
Case.
Yes.
Yeah, I believe so.
Of course.
Yeah.
Another principle of law. 524G.
This one was decided right at the end of the term, June 6th. Any event, I will offer. I was going to say this till the end, but I guess I'll offer it at the beginning, and you can tell me whether you agree at the end. But I'm sort of surprised that a case like this
got up there.
Yeah, it gets all the way up there.
I agree.
You know, at the end of the day, you know, it's one thing to disagree with somebody's arguments, but it's quite another to not even let them speak.
Right.
Which I think is the, you know, the principle at issue here, under 1109B, which
is
the,
was there a circuit split on this? Does that explain anything?
I don't remember.
I think there is. There was. Okay.
Yeah,
go ahead. I'll look it up.
All right. So, 1109B is the party in interest section, basically, allowing, a non-exhaustive list of parties to raise and appear and be heard on any issue in a case under this chapter. And this is an insurer that's trying to block a plan that established a trust for current and future asbestos injury liabilities. The key in it was, and what really got the insurance company involved in objecting to the plan, was that in the holders of insured claims were treated differently than the holders of uninsured claims. If you had an insured claim, you essentially just go ahead and sue your insurance company, and you guys figure it out. We're not going to alter the insurer's rights in any way under their contracts. But if you had an underinsured claim, then you submit that directly to the trust. And when you do so, you do have to provide certain disclosures to ensure to the trust, whoever the trustee of the trust is, to ensure that the trust pays only valid and sort of non-duplicative claims. This obviously can be a big issue in mass tort cases. It was a huge issue in the Boy Scouts case, all sorts of complaints about duplicative claims or fraudulent claims, right? So these disclosures had to be made. Only for the uninsured claims that went straight to the trust. And the insurer is saying, well, if they should have to make those disclosures to us as well.
You're just shifting that cost of running down the fraud to us.
To us, right. Exactly.
Where it was all along.
Right. And the question is, under those circumstances, is the insurer a party in interest that can appear and be heard on the plan? The bankruptcy court said that it was not, because the plan, left, its rights under the insurance contract, sort of where it found them. And, there's this concept of insurance neutrality. And I gather it's a concept that's been repeated by, the courts. The idea is that a plan, you know, where it neither increases the pre-petition obligations or impairs the insurer's rights under insurance contracts, then the plan is said to be sort of insurance neutral. And that's what the bankruptcy court said. The district court affirmed. Court of Appeals for the Fourth Circuit affirmed.
Yeah, we decide this all the time. There's nothing to this, right?
Yep. And so here we are. Petitioners say, you know, look, 1109B, right to be heard, sort of coextensive with Article 3, the typical sort of injury in fact kind of analysis. Here the petitioner, an insurer, is responsible for paying the bankruptcy claims at the end of the day, and it's a creditor, and therefore it has the right to be heard and to object to the plan. And they sort of dispense with this insurance neutrality doctrine, saying it really doesn't have a basis in Article 3 or in the bankruptcy code. The arguments on the other side, you know, apparently the argument is that the way this plan was drafted, It doesn't affect the rights or obligations directly of the insurance company. It's not enough that they have an executory contract. Article 3 standing even isn't enough. Their alleged injuries as an insurer are not enough. Same thing with the asbestos claimants. Unless the plan alters the insurer's legally protected interests, which they say it didn't here, it's not enough. And there's this idea, too, and this is raised in one of the amicus briefs, that this alleged injury of having to pick up these costs of doing the investigation of these claims and so on, it's just speculative. You're sort of assuming that there's going to be fraud in a mass tort situation.
It's a valid assumption in many cases, isn't it?
Probably so. So opinion of Justice Sotomayor, I think Alito did not participate in this one for some reason.
Probably owns stock. He owns a lot of stock. He recuses himself more than the other justices from stock ownership.
So they tackle the insurance neutrality doctrine right out of the gate, and Sotomayor says it conflates the merits of an insurer's objection with the threshold 1109B question of who qualifies as a party in interest. So she ultimately, the majority, concludes you got to ask whether the reorganization proceedings in general directly affect a party, not how a particular plan actually affects them. So it's sort of taking a step back. We're not going to look at this on a plan-by-plan basis. We're going to look at the entire bankruptcy proceedings. And the standard that they seem to adopt, it appears to me quite broad, as it probably should be under 1109B. Is the party sufficiently sufficiently concerned with or affected by the proceedings to be a party in interest. And that, as she sees it, is the plain meaning of a party in interest, entities potentially concerned with or affected by a proceeding. She goes on to talk about how, look, this is a good idea anyway, because we want to promote greater participation. Who better than to appear and be heard than the party who's actually footing the bill at the end of the day? Insurers play huge roles in these mass tort cases. Quite interestingly, and perhaps confirming my initial point about this case, she concludes by saying, look, there may be difficult cases that require courts to evaluate whether truly peripheral parties have a sufficiently direct interest. This case is not one of them. So it seems to be easy.
Yeah.
Right. So that's to answer your question you started with.
Yeah.
That was the basis for CERT, right? So the 1109B says a party in interest, including the debtor, a bunch of other people, creditors, may raise and appear and be heard on any issue in a case under this chapter. So courts, including the Seventh, yeah, have read. So according to the CERT petition, I think this is an accurate characterization of the case to which it refers. Applying this like party in interest concept that brings other standing requirements along with it, the Fourth and the Seventh had said. Applying the interpretation of 1109B, the Seventh Circuit refused to allow a creditor to object to plan confirmation. The court denied bankruptcy standing because the creditor objected to the assumption of a lease in which it didn't have a specific interest. So I think it's presented below. The question was, well, the insurance company doesn't have a specific interest in any of this because it's insurance neutral, and therefore they don't have standing, notwithstanding the fact that they're a creditor and 1109 says what it says. And so that was the conflict that was presented in the circuits. And then the Supreme Court kind of says, well, they're a creditor, so we don't care about that. Right. Yeah. And so then it appears to be like, why are we yeah, reading this case then?
Well, we're reading this because some of the lower courts come to a different conclusion and we don't like
it. Right. But it kind of been spun out differently.
Yeah, I agree. Right? I agree. And to me, it's a simple enough and I think straightforward and correct. You know, we know what bankruptcy plan proceedings, you know, negotiation and approval and all of that are like. You know, you want to be invited to the party. If you've got a potential, issue that may arise in the course of it, and and the insurance company in this case certainly did. It had things it wanted to
okay, but
cover.
That's fair, right? Yeah. But the argument on the other side is, so that means that a creditor could come in, object to the plan, make a big stink of confirmation, right. even though their argument is going to have no effect on them.
Yeah. Well, that would be easy to reject their objection then, wouldn't it?
Right. Well, but that's the argument. The argument is that you don't want to like have everybody in. And now, like, I'm kind of with you. I think that probably gets like, you know, the economic incentives kind of
right,
that.
Right.
Yeah, How often is that happening?
Right. You know that she also noted in her opinion, Congress has consistently acted to promote greater participation in reorganization.
Yeah, I'm not against you on this. I'm just saying.
You'll listen to them before you deny.
Always listen.
Well, the one case we got, I'm not sure we'll spend a half hour, whatever we got left, 20 some minutes on it, that the Supreme Court has granted cert on is kind of interesting. I hope so, at least. And it is, has to do with getting a, setting aside, as a, fraudulent transfer under the trustees' strong arm powers of 544B, an amount of money that the principals, you know, think Stacklers, what was the other case we talked about? The amount of money that they paid in to taxes that would reduce their tax liability. So in other words, they're causing the company on the lead up to bankruptcy to make payments with the ideal of limiting the number of the amount of money that the principals of the business would have to pay back. So this is one of those cases. Bankruptcy proceedings in Utah. Company before it filed for bankruptcy protection paid $145,000 to the IRS to be applied to the personal tax obligations of two of its principals, both of whom were shareholders, officers, and directors. And you hear this every day, right? This happens all the time. And then an analysis prepared during the subsequent bankruptcy showed that at the time those payments were made, the company was insolvent. And among its debts when it filed for bankruptcy, there was an unpaid judgment and a single unpaid judgment resulting from a discrimination lawsuit brought by a former employee. Those are the ingredients that are going to give rise to this this issue. So the case is converted from Chapter 11 to 7. Trustee brought an adversary proceeding against the United States under 544B and 544A. Seeking to avoid and recover the IRS payments. In other words, under the strong arm powers of 544B and under the fraudulent transfer provisions of the code itself. What's the difference? One's got a 2-year statute of limitations and some of the payments were made more than 2 years before the bankruptcy filing. So 548 isn't going to work. So, the bankruptcy court so held, but it granted summary judgment to the trustee on his 544B claim, which relied on Utah's version of the UFTA, like ours, as a 4-year statute of limitations. It's very frequent. Longer statute of limitations than the federal statute. The trustee argued that there is an actual creditor, this guy with a judgment for discrimination, so you meet that requirement of 544B. And the government didn't dispute in this case that the tax payments satisfied Utah's fraudulent transfer definition because the company paid its principal's taxes, not its own. So what are we talking about here? Well, as the trustee conceded, sovereign immunity would bar the former employee's suit against the United States. So the former employee had sued to recover a fraudulent transfer under these same circumstances, because this was fraudulent as to him, he would sue the IRS, and the IRS would say, pound sand, we're the government, go away. You can't sue us. We are the sovereign. You can't sue the king. So the government argued that the challenge payments weren't voidable under applicable state law by a creditor holding an unsecured claim because it would have been barred by sovereign immunity. But the bankruptcy court said that Section 106, the waiver of sovereign immunity, which is a pretty broad waiver, the waiver of sovereign immunity abrogates that sovereign immunity in the bankruptcy context entirely, not just within the bankruptcy proceeding, but also for purposes of interposing immunity as a defense to the underlying state cause of action. The language is very broad. Notwithstanding an assertion of sovereign immunity is abrogated as to a governmental unit, get back to that in a minute, to the extent set forth in this section with respect to the following. There follows a laundry list of sections of the bankruptcy court as to which sovereign immunity is abolished, which include 544, 545, 546, 547, 548, 549, 550. You would expect, right, the stuff that goes on. You can sue the government. And by the way, strong amicus support for the government's position is being maintained by attorneys general of about 34 states.
That's surprising.
Right? Because they're also... their sovereign immunity has also been waived by Congress. This is a big deal. The trustee argued, I'm sorry, where was I here? The bankruptcy court held that 106A abrogates sovereign immunity entirely in the bankruptcy context with respect to actions under these sections, not just within the bankruptcy proceeding itself, but it actually prevented the interposition of immunity as a defense to the underlying state cause of action. It also rejected the government's argument that the revenue code would preempt a suit of this kind because it implicates the field of federal tax collection. That is, there was field preemption of this, which didn't strike me as a very attractive argument, didn't strike the bankruptcy court that either. They awarded judgment against the United States. The district court affirmed, adopted the bankruptcy court's reasoning in full. I'm sure that happens to all the bankruptcy judges here. The Court of Appeals also affirmed, holding that 106A reaches the underlying state law cause of action that 544B1, that is the Uniform Fraudulent Transfer Act case, authorizes the trustee to rely on in seeking to avoid the transfers. Section 106A waives sovereign immunity with respect to 544, which generally has a broadening effect, reflecting Congress's intent that the waiver reach any subject that has a connection with the topics the statute enumerates. Maybe a stretch, maybe not. There's a split in the circuits. We know why the Supreme Court took this, beside the fact that it's seeking money for the government, which usually draws the attention of the Supreme Court. The Court of Appeals decision in the Tenth Circuit is consistent with the Ninth Circuit's decision, and there's another one from the Fourth Circuit, but it conflicts with, or the Second, it conflicts with the Seventh Circuit decision in 2014. Judge Flom's decision in a case called Equipment Acquisition Resources, Inc., which held that, no, it just, you know, the narrow, it, it does not, it does not, the unpaid creditor couldn't bring a fraudulent transfer action, so the government, the trustee can't either. The Court of Appeals rejected the government's argument of preemption. Field preemption is not the most popular argument to make ever, but holding that if Congress thought that another federal statute posed an obstacle to its objectives, it surely would have added an express preemption provision. So the petitioner, the IRS here, argues that the trustee invoking 544B is subject to the same limitations that would have applied to that existing creditor who could have sought relief outside of bankruptcy, so that if there was any reason why that creditor couldn't prevail, res judicata, waiver, statute of limitations, estoppel, immunity, the trustee is similarly barred, and it's undisputed that no actual creditor could have brought a successful suit against the IRS. So the trustee can't accomplish more by stepping in to such a creditor's shoes. The government also argues that the waiver in 106A relating to 544 allows the trustee to bring a 544 claim against the government, but the bankruptcy court must actually adjudicate the merits of the trustee's claim just as it would under the enumerated sections of the code. So in doing so, the court must determine whether the source of the substantive law upon which the trustee relies provides an avenue for relief, saying that that latter question is analytically distinct from the question whether there's been a waiver of sovereign immunity. The IRS argues that nothing in 106 creates a substantive claim for relief. Maybe broad, they say, but there's no evidence that Congress intended it to alter 544B's substantive requirements. This is a good Solicitor General's brief. It argues everything they can think of. Federal tax collection is a matter of federal constitutional law to which any contrary state law must yield under the Supremacy Clause. I don't think that's going anywhere. Respondent waived its argument. This may go somewhere. You waive your argument that a creditor avoids sovereign immunity if it can avoid a transfer against another defendant like the principals, and then recover the payment from the IRS. It was either neither present nor passed on below. The trustee argues that 106's clear waiver of sovereign immunity with respect to 544, and it is very clear, covers all aspects of 544B claims. Congress instructed courts to proceed notwithstanding the assertion of sovereign immunity. In the government's world, no 544B claims against governments can ever succeed, nor could trustees invoke against governments any other bankruptcy provisions that incorporate state law. Congress couldn't have intended these results when it waived sovereign immunity. So those are sort of the arguments that we're dealing with here. The government is elevating itself to a super creditor status by allowing it and it alone to keep all ill-gotten windfalls. And reversal would create a playbook for fraud. Pay personal taxes, debts with corporate funds first, let the IRS hide behind sovereign immunity later. Imagine that. I suspect that won't be thought of as evil as milking by the Sacklers, but I don't know. Not surprisingly, 23 states in the District of Columbia agree with the United States that there is no waiver of sovereign immunity in this instance. Also, somewhat predictably, former Judge Weedoff and various law professors have argued that the government's position violates the longstanding presumption against ineffectiveness, a textually permissible interpretation that furthers rather than obstructs the document's purpose should be favored. The National Association of Bankruptcy Trustees, surprise, surprise, they think that the government should lose as well, pointing out that when a governmental unit files a proof of claim in a bankruptcy proceeding, it has waived any defense of sovereign immunity and compulsory counterclaims. And by filing a proof of claim, the IRS waived any claim of sovereign immunity. We'll see how that sorts out.
So creditor walks into a court, the United States.
Just like a guy walking into a bar?
Yeah, on a fraudulent conveyance action.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And all of the requirements of the fraudulent conveyance action are met. Then what happens? Government says sovereign immunity, right?
Right.
That's an affirmative defense, right?
I don't know. I don't know.
Well, change the example then. Let's assume that a creditor sues, all the requirements of the statute are met, but the defendant has an affirmative defense.
Okay.
So the affirmative defense can be waived. Right, and I know waiving sovereign immunity is complicated, but it can be waived.
Congress said that the defense of sovereign immunity
we're
is
not talking
abrogated.
About this. Wait, this is completely out of bankruptcy.
Okay.
Take this completely
all right.
out of bankruptcy. Forget about the bankruptcy code. This is all happening.
Milwaukee County Circuit Court.
Yes, right. And now I know what you're going to say. They removed. So I get it. We're in front of Ludwig. Isn't sovereign immunity an affirmative defense?
I don't know.
Let's say it is.
Yeah.
Then is it voidable under applicable law?
You know, there are those cases saying that when the state of Wisconsin removes cases to which it has an 11th Amendment defense into federal court, they waive it. They waive sovereign. They waive their 11th Amendment defense.
Right.
Judge Griesbach.
But my question is designed to get at the idea of what is applicable law means.
I understand. Don't know the answer. Good question. I was waiting to read you the quote with which Circuit Judge Baldock in the 10th Circuit began his opinion in this case, because I know it will rankle Judge Halfinger. Quoting Justice Frankfurter.
I'm glad we saved that for the end then.
Quoting Justice Frankfurter. All our work is a matter of semantics. Words, 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 right?
Word games.
Word games.
This is one thing that I was kind of wondering throughout the briefs on this, and I think we're just about – we didn't get the last brief of the petitioner, I don't think.
Oh, that's why it hadn't been sent for a while.
Yeah. So we didn't – I actually will probably take a look at that. But I'm wondering if there's an example here of a 544 claim that can be brought against a government – if not this one, right? Because you've got, 106 has this list of all these different provisions in the code that, they say abrogated sovereign immunity.
Oh, it's interesting. In the In Re Equipment Acquisition Resources case from the Seventh Circuit, there were a bunch of claims brought by, I think, the state of Illinois or somebody, and those under 548, they lost. The one under 544B, they won because of this distinction, which the 10th Circuit says is meaningless distinction. So I don't know. I can see why the 38 or 43 or whatever it was, 23 states don't want this to happen.
I didn't see, incidentally, I didn't see that there are any other petitions, bankruptcy-related petitions pending before the Supreme Court. So you got a case. Get it up there. Otherwise, next year it could be quiet.
That's right. It's probably not a good idea to have your case be one going to the Supreme Court. If you can win it in such a way that they can't touch it, isn't that better?
So I don't understand that last point. 544 is on that list.
Yeah.
But 544B is the one that has a state law aspect to it. I mean, that's the distinction.
But it's not, it doesn't say like 544A.
It says
544.
I know it does. I know it does. And the 10th Circuit mocks the 7th Circuit's reliance on that kind of an argument. But the 7th Circuit isn't the only circuit which has said, well, there's more to it. This isn't just federal law. This is the offensive aspect of it is that 544B allows the trustee to enforce state law, whether of Utah or Illinois.
It says applicable law. That's what it says.
Like I know how you would rule. You'd affirm the 10th Circuit.
No, I don't know how I'd rule, but I'm just saying what the statute says. It says applicable law.
There you are again, Mike. Always read the goddamn statute. What chance do any of us have?
Well, so we'll see what they do next year.
Right. Questions, comments?
Any questions from the virtual participants? No questions. All right. Thank you, everyone.